Item one, healthcare is back in the news. Item two, inflation kinda is as well. Item three, tipping. 18%, y'all, at least, please. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosdahl. It is Monday today, December the 17th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We comment not infrequently on this program about market forces and how once set in motion, it takes a whole lot to turn them around. It applies to the coal industry in this country, which is losing out to cheaper and cleaner natural gas. It's showing up in the trade war. American soybean farmers looking for new markets for their products, just for instance. And also, it is showing up in healthcare. The Affordable Care Act, Obamacare in the vernacular, is back in the news, as you've heard, thanks to that ruling down in Texas on Friday night. It is going to be a while, anyway, before the courts and possibly Congress are done with this round of fighting over the ACA. But Marketplace's Andy Euler reports that it has brought some lasting changes that law has to American healthcare that will likely survive, even if the law itself might not.
You know how fast food joints now have on the menu how many calories are in the burger and fries you just ordered? That labeling requirement was part of the Affordable Care Act. Another thing the ACA did was change the way doctors and hospitals get paid. Michael McWilliams is a professor of healthcare policy at Harvard. He says the ACA tried to push the industry away from fee-for-service payments
to a system in which the financial incentives are more aligned with actually reducing wasteful spending and improving health outcomes.
He says the ACA put a heavy focus on an explicit connection between reimbursement and quality of care. Jury's still out on whether it's worked. Scott Harrington, healthcare management professor at the Wharton School of Business, says Obamacare changed the way the insurance industry thinks about its role.
Companies have invested a lot of resources to think about how they can come up with products that will provide access to care for people, but do so at a lower cost, thus helping to keep premiums down.
Of course, that's not really happening right now. The ACA has also led to some changes in the pharmaceutical industry. Rena Conti at Boston University says the ACA expanded Medicaid rebates on drugs, making some drugs cheaper for state Medicaid plans. But
whether or not individual payers or individual consumers could have the same impact on the industry that the federal government choosing to implement these changes into federal law could have, we don't know.
We also don't know what will ultimately become of the ACA in the courts, but whatever happens, the Affordable Care Act will remain part of our health care future. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
The economic future of the biggest city in this country is looking more tech than it did a couple of days ago. Google confirmed this morning it's going to double its footprint in New York City, $1 billion for new digs in Lower Manhattan, and a Big Apple workforce of 14,000 in the next decade or so. You take the Amazon HQ2 news a couple of weeks ago, 25,000 new workers in Long Island City, Queens over the next decade. And one can only wonder, in this era of cloud computing and hipster coffee shops in virtually every town, why are tech giants expanding in the biggest and most crowded and most expensive of American cities? Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that story.
When we think about famous origin stories for today's tech giants, the suburbs loom large, says Margaret O'Meara, a tech historian who teaches at the University of Washington. Think Steve Jobs in his garage.
The research park or the corporate campus has really been the native home for American high tech since the 1950s.
There are reasons for that, she says. When the defense industry was investing in early tech during the Cold War, they purposely put the facilities outside major cities, which could be in the path of nuclear bombs. But the suburbs back then were also where people wanted to live. Today, not so much.
Young, college-educated, skilled technical professionals, you know, in their 20s and early 30s, they want to live in places like Manhattan and downtown Seattle and San Francisco.
O'Meara says over recent years, we've seen the migration of high-tech industry into cities, but not just any cities. While Apple recently announced a new hub in Austin, most companies are heading to wealthy coastal urban centers where talent is already concentrated.
You're getting this self-reinforcing phenomenon.
Richard Florida is an urban studies professor at the University of Toronto. He's tracked the consolidation of wealth and high-wage jobs in what he calls superstar cities like New York and San Francisco.
I think it's because talent wants to be around other talent, and talent wants an exciting and diverse environment.
And once the talent is there, companies pile on. But that exacerbates the growing tech divide between the coasts and the rest of the country. And even in those successful cities, rising costs can force out the very cultural vibrancy that made them attractive in the first place. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
All right, here's another glimpse of market-based reality. Last Thursday and into Friday, wind energy companies outbid each other for the right to build wind farms off the coast of Massachusetts. And get this, the winning bids were higher than the latest auction prices to drill for offshore oil. Translation, a lot of people are betting on America as the next big emerging market for offshore wind. Scott Tong has that one from the Sustainability Desk.
The federal government auctioned off three blocks of water starting on Thursday morning. The first bids were $250,000 each, and then they soared to $100 million on Friday. Stephanie McClellan heads the offshore wind program at the University of Delaware.
You really see, okay, here's the four or five companies that are going to fight this to the death.
Eventually, each winner paid a record $135 million. That's triple the price of an auction 2 years ago.
What blew most of us away was the significant investment that these companies were willing to make.
What's behind the bets on American offshore wind power? Well, many Atlantic states offer subsidies, and offshore wind energy is competitive. The price has plummeted 75% in 4 years. One huge efficiency is turbine blades as long as football fields, says veteran engineer Walt Musial at the National Renewable Energy Lab.
We never expected machines to get this big, so I really have stopped predicting how big they can get. These are some of the biggest machines ever built by humans.
He predicts offshore wind farms off the West Coast, the Gulf of Mexico, and the Great Lakes, as well as in Europe and Asia. Now, in this auction, two of the winners are oil companies with offshore drilling experience, Shell and Equinor, the former Statoil. Chris Carr is in the energy practice at the law firm Baker Botts.
The oil and gas majors do not have ideological commitments to one form of energy. There's no sort of purity requirements.
They just see green in green energy. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, the opposite of green. One word, five syllables. It's a noun, a tendency to change quickly and unpredictably. Any guesses? Volatility. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We spent a whole lot of time this year on a project that we call Divided Decade, how the financial crisis in the last 10 years in this economy changed things. A lot is the short answer, right? There is more inequality now. More people are insecure about their financial futures. And workers in this economy who were just getting set to retire when the bottom fell out are still trying to get back. Marketplace's Erica Barris reports.
Kathy Stevens shows me around her place in Riverview Towers, a high-rise for seniors in Pittsburgh. Her apartment has a small kitchen and living area.
Some people like to cook. I'm not one of them.
There's also an accordion door she can pull to close off the space with her bed.
If you have company or something, you can do this. Some of the places actually have a separate room.
Stevens, who's 67, pays $840 a month in rent. That includes utilities and dinner every day. She says the apartment is fine, but it's not where she expected to be at this point in her life. She has an MBA from Harvard and spent her career in financial services. At one time, she had about $1 million in a retirement account.
I did all the right things. I saved my money. I didn't waste it on, you know, a big, big house or a big car or whatever.
She also raised two foster sons and supported them into adulthood, using some of her retirement savings to help them go into business. She was hoping to send her grandchildren to college. Then the financial crisis hit.
And now all of a sudden, like 35% of my money is just gone, like vanished. It was really bad. It was a shock. There's no other word for it. It was a shock.
The economic collapse was a shock to nearly everyone. Millions of people lost their jobs and their homes. For many, it would take years to recover, if they recovered at all. But for those closest to retirement,
it meant that you never had the time to make that up.
That's Teresa Ghilarducci, an economist at the New School for Social Research. She says the reality for nearly half a generation of newly minted seniors, and millions more on their way,
is that you are downwardly mobile.
In fact, the number of seniors filing for bankruptcy has nearly doubled since 2007 to a high of 12%. The financial crisis was a big part of that. So is mounting debt for things like medical care, mortgage loans, and credit card bills. Bankruptcy can be a fresh, debt-free start if you're still working, says Deborah Thorne with the Consumer Bankruptcy Project.
The pickle is, for older people, that's highly unlikely.
And, says Thorne, on top of the financial crisis, seniors were also confronting another fundamental shift in the economy. Professionally managed pensions were giving way to 401ks, where individuals are responsible for their own retirement savings.
It's a skill to know how much a person is supposed to save and when they're supposed to withdraw and at what amount. This is the generation where we're really seeing the fallout from the transition to individuals being responsible for that.
Take Larry Testerman. He's 73, an Air Force vet. He had a successful career in marketing and put two sons through college. In the early 2000s, he was laid off from his $85,000 a year job and got divorced. He was also caring for his ailing mother.
I probably was not able to look after my investments in my retirement accounts as I should have been, and perhaps should have just sold them all out promptly when things started declining.
Testerman lost half his savings. He went back to work, stocking shelves at grocery stores. But eventually, he could no longer make his mortgage payments, and his condo went into foreclosure. Now he drives a shuttle bus at a Utah ski resort for $10.60 an hour and spends part of the year in employee housing.
The space that I'm living in is a room that has a bathroom and a set of bunk beds in it, with me sleeping on the bottom, another person sleeping on top.
Testerman is part of a fast-growing group of seniors who work part-time, low-wage jobs and worry about how long they'll be able to continue.
I don't know how long I can do this to just stay afloat until I can't stay afloat. That's kind of all I have to look forward to, is reaching a point that I can't stay afloat.
And that larger reality is something the entire country will need to confront as a generation of people who thought they were better prepared for retirement find that they have run out of resources and out of time. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
You report on something for a whole year, you learn some things. We put some of our key findings from our 12 months of looking into how the financial crisis changed this economy and the people living in it on our website. Today, lessons of how housing has changed in the past 10 years is at marketplace.org/divided decade. With an eye on the monetary policy calendar, which is a snooty way of saying the Fed meets this week on interest rates, we're going to revisit some people we had on the program about a month and a half ago talking about inflation, which, as we have been telling you, is sitting at just about 2.2% on an annualized basis, pretty much where the Fed wants it. Anyway, we had asked these folks what they might not buy if prices got too high. Wine, cable television, movies, and dating apps came up on that list. But then we also asked them what they would buy no matter what. And we got appliances, newspaper delivery, yay journalism, also milk. So we called them back up the other day to see how they are feeling now.
Hey, Marketplace. This is Michael Devitt in Boise, Idaho. As a healthcare practitioner, I hate to share this, but some lab tests that I get frequently, the last time I had it about 2 weeks ago, the price was almost 15% higher than it has typically been. So that was a little bit of a shock. And I know you're wanting to know more about inflation, but just in terms of spending power, my wife and I just recently got our property tax assessment. And for the second year in a row, our taxes have gone up 23%. So that equates to about $350 a month extra that we will be paying for our mortgage.
Hi, Marketplace. It's Ernesto. Walgreens has started carrying again the milk brand that I like, and they're carrying it for what they used to carry it, which is about 60 to 70 cents cheaper than the local supermarkets. I mean, it's less than a dollar difference, but every little bit helps.
Hi, Marketplace. This is Ellen Murphy in Prairie Village, Kansas.
Well, since last time, the romaine lettuce recall happened. And so I bought a lot of different lettuces than I usually do, but I found that the red and green leaf lettuce, the spinaches, and the kales were extremely inexpensive. I don't know if they were marked down because the romaine was unavailable. but you can get more of them and for a lot less, and it goes farther.
That was Ellen Murphy in Prairie Village, Kansas, right there to round things out. Also Michael Devitt in Boise, Idaho, and Ernesto in Chicago. Coming up.
Honestly, it wasn't working on the customer side or on the business side for restaurants.
Don't forget to tip your server. Seriously. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, the Wawa's today. Markets, well, they just fretted. They fretted about everything. The Dow Industrial is off 507 points today, just over 2%, 23,592. The NASDAQ off 156, 2.25%, 67.53. The S&P 500 down 54 points, 2%, 25.45. Healthcare stocks were pounded today after that federal judge's ruling that we told you about on Friday. Hospital company Tenet slid 1.4%. HCA Healthcare declined 2.8%. Health insurers down as well. Anthem off 3.2%. United Healthcare dropped 2.6% today. Bond prices, meanwhile, rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.85%. You're listening to Marketplace. Here's an investment opportunity with a guaranteed return. When you donate to support Marketplace today, your gift will be matched dollar for dollar by our friends at the Candida Fund. Listeners like you who give to Marketplace do more than help keep the show on the air. You help us grow and get better. It's a way to directly support independent reporting and journalism that you trust. And the payoff comes with what you hear every day. Don't miss out on this chance to make your donation go twice as far. Please give today at Marketplace.org. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The last evacuation orders for Paradise, California were lifted over the weekend, more than a month after that community was all but destroyed by wildfire. Some homes were spared, yes, most, about 14,000 or so were not. So going back means searching for another place to live or maybe something temporary while people wait to rebuild. And as Marketplace's Ben Bradford reports, that is no easy search in a place where housing was already in short supply.
Kelly Connor is remarkably upbeat, considering. She's looking out the window of her newly purchased used RV across the dried-out field where she's parked behind her son's house.
There was like 50 quail running across here. It was so cool.
The fire burned down Connor's print shop in Paradise and her home of 14 years to the north. Connor describes a prefab home with a two-car garage and a little barn in the back. But now...
I have a flag in my front yard, and the flag is standing. And then there's nothing in the background, you know, where my house was. So when I saw that, I was like,
She wants to rebuild, maybe even expand, and she's counting on her home insurance check to help. She says the RV will let her move closer onto a friend's lot in Paradise. Every fire survivor has had a sudden decision to make about where to live, temporarily or permanently, but options are limited in the area.
Motels and rentals and things like that were just non-existent.
Housing in Chico, the largest and nearest city to Paradise, was tight before the fire.
Chico can't absorb 30,000 people. We barely had the capacity to absorb what we were getting.
David Bronson is president of the Chico Realtors Association. Hotels remain sold out for 20 miles around, and most days there's literally not a single unit available for rent. Bronson says the 2 weeks after the fire, 200 houses sold, some for tens of thousands of dollars above asking price, and less than 60 remained on the market.
For a city of 80 plus thousand people, that's almost nothing.
Buying a home is often considered synonymous with the American dream, and as a realtor, Michelle Moy knows something about that. But her own home purchase was an act of desperation.
This wasn't obviously the time for us to buy, but what am I going to do? And I think a lot of people are in the same situation.
Moy was a renter in Paradise who describes a terrifying last-minute escape. She and her fiancé met up at his father's house in a remote area without internet about an hour from where Moy is now working in Chico. She needed to be closer, so they used the $15,000 from their renter's insurance and their savings for a down payment.
All this money I've got, you understand, is going towards me getting another place. Like, I don't have any money left over from this.
It's still 40 minutes away in the city of Oroville. But for people who can't afford to buy, they really have two options. Find someone to move in with or move out.
Yeah.
500 people are still sleeping on cots laid out in rows at evacuation shelters. Many were already homeless. Others, like Julie Pearson and her son James, were renters with few resources, and even less now.
We lost everything but the clothes on our back.
Pearson says they live on disability insurance and don't have good credit. They're not sure when or how far they'll have to move to find an apartment that'll take them. Where Pearson would like to go is impossible.
I would give anything to be able to go back to Paradise. I was born and raised there, and so were my kids, so we don't know anything but Paradise.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, is readying as many as 2,000 trailers for the area, but the only long-term solution is to build new homes to make up for the ones that were lost. I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
Coming up tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, some new numbers from the federal government on homelessness. It's up, even as unemployment's at record lows and more cities are trying to get more people into permanent shelters. Anybody who's ever waited tables for a living knows how hit or miss your nightly take-home can be living in a tip economy. Busy nights, you can do all right. Slower nights, not so much. And either way, it's usually never great. A couple of years ago, some big-name restaurateurs, mostly in New York, decided they would do away with tips, set a standard wage, and maybe get their people a little bit more. Now, though, as Nikita Richardson writes about at Grub Street, the no-tip thing is fallen out of favor. Welcome to the program.
Hi, happy to be here.
So it was a big deal couple of 3 years ago when these restaurants started getting rid of tips, right?
Yeah, it was a huge revolution in this way that things have always been done, which is through tipping. And all these big restaurants were like, we're done with it,
right,
and we're going to move on to tip included.
And here we are now, 3 years later, and it seems, based on what you report in this piece, that maybe it hasn't worked out so well.
Yeah, unfortunately, it just a lot of restaurants around the United States, not even just here in New York, but in, you know, Seattle, Detroit, San Francisco, they've gone back to tipping because, honestly, it wasn't working on the customer side or on the business side for restaurants.
Well, so let's break that down a little bit, and let's do the business side and the restaurants first. It's a managerial kind of headache for them not to do the tipping thing.
For sure. Ultimately, the biggest problem for restaurants is staff turnover. Not enough restaurants bought into this concept. And without buy-in from a lot of the major restaurants, then a waiter who is no longer getting tipped and has seen his or her wages fall by sometimes up to $10,000 in a year, they will just leave and go to another place, but where they will get tips. And so staff turnover became a huge problem, and which is already a problem within the restaurant industry because it is that type of industry where people move from restaurant to restaurant, job to job, because that's in a lot of ways, that's the best way to move up.
Right. So just to be clear here, tipping went away and servers saw their wages go down.
Yes, in a lot of cases, because the idea was to have you just have a minimum wage. So now everyone would get paid $25 an hour. Tipping would be included in the cost of the meal, which raises your menu prices. That's a whole other thing on the customer side.
Well, it is a whole other thing. So let's get to the customer side, right? Because now you see the restaurants adding 20% to the bill with a little note at the bottom that says, no need to tip. We're adding 20% to your bill to make sure everybody gets a decent wage. But customers are just looking at the bottom line saying, wait a minute, what?
Yeah. So there are some restaurants that have put, we have a 20% gratuity, right? That's included. But in a lot of these restaurants, there wasn't that note. It's just like, we are a non-tipping restaurant. So what happened was the cost of items on their menu went up by 20%. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole psychological part about this, about how people like to have the cost of something broken down. So you pay $5 for this plus $5 in shipping, instead of just saying $10 shipping included. $10 just feels more expensive, even if it's the same amount.
Right. Well, that gets to the whole behavioral economics part of this, which is that, as you report, customers actually like to be able to tip. I guess it's a control thing, right?
It is for sure a control thing. It's very much an issue of power. People are like, I always tip 20%, but what if you feel like the service wasn't that great? Right. Now you can bring your tip down to 15%. You have this kind of power through tipping that is taken away when tips are eliminated. And customers just are not comfortable with that. There's a study where Joe's Crab Shack eliminated tipping, and the locations that it eliminated tipping had lower customer ratings on Yelp just because people needed to get that out of their system. They needed to say, how can I express my dissatisfaction, or not even just dissatisfaction, satisfaction too.
Right.
My service was wonderful and I can't even tip them. Right.
Nikita Richardson writes for Grub Street, part of New York Magazine. She does food and a bunch of other stuff, including now tips and the economics of all that. Nikita, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, a tip of the automotive styling cap to the Ford Motor Company. Ford said today it's going to make a special 80th anniversary edition of the Lincoln Continental next year with suicide doors. You know, the ones where the front doors open normally and the rear doors open backwards, I guess is a good way to say it. It's only making 80 of them, though. See, also 80th anniversary edition. So, of course, they're not going to be cheap, a bit more than six figures, but still, cool. All right, we're done. The Dow off a bit more than 2% today. NASDAQ 2.25% to the downside. S&P 500 off 2% as well. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, Phoebe Unterman, and Daniel Shin. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. I'm Kai Rosdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.